Welcome to the Yeshiva Shalmaila. This is David Lichtenstein. We're going to be speaking about Trump, Republican, the Democrats, Biden. I speak to Fruma people and say, well, we're leaving Teretz Yisrael. This is the end. It's the absolute end. If they win, you're going to have Black Lives Matter. AOC is going to be running the country together with the squad. It's time to run. So I said, you know, let's put together a really intelligent group of people who could tell us, is there truth to this? And that's from a practical point of view. So we're going to have Senator Joseph Lieberman. He's the only Fruma Senate. He was a senator for 30 years. He has Baruch Hashem Fruma kids, B'nai Torah, Einiklach, living in Eretz Yisrael. He was the vice president candidate for the Democratic Party, knows Biden very well personally, and he won, actually, the most popular votes. But they lost the Electoral College in that famous. So he's going to be on the program speaking about how dangerous it is for us. Then the moral point of view, a number of Rabbanim put out a letter that was printed in many of the local papers and was called Sinai, Not Washington. And it discusses it. Here are a number of moral questions. Should party platforms substitute our Messiah? There's much moral degradation in the Republican Party. We had on Ben Shapiro, he spoke about it. He says, these are the things I agree with, these are the things I disagree with. But you know, we have a presidential candidate who's undisputed, has had multiple wives, many affairs, has been sued by more people maybe than any other American for theft or fraud. He had a school that paid big fines for allegedly ripping off its students. He does good things for Klal Yisrael, without a doubt. But should Israel be used as a political weapon? Or do we have a set of morals that we say, I'm sorry? Should we vote as Jews or as just members of one party? Should we allow ourselves to be co-opted by any party? Are we supposed to be Ur Lagoyim when we singing Zmiris to a certain candidate who has many parts of him that are really, you know, every one of the Aseres HaDibros, you could say, was Nisbatel, right? Or almost everyone. But he's in our best interests. Is there a moral issue there? Are we Ur Lagoyim when we do that? This is what we're going to be debating. So here's a clip from Rabbi Yitzchak Feldheim. He's a full-throated Trump supporter. That's what he says about this debate.
Oy, Reb David, people really ask this? It's shocking. I just don't get it. You have a house that's on fire, it's full of kids, there's flames, and there's one fireman brave enough to rush into the house, and people are kvetching that he has mud on his boots. Oh, they're going to say, no, it's very muddy boots. There's eight kinds of mud on his boots. These are the kind of objections that invalidate someone instantly from moral discourse. This is what we mean when we talk about Das Torah. Ben Torah understands, Ashrei sasamta chalkeinu b'yoshe beit ha-medrash. We understand bein din l'din, what's normal and what's narishkeit. Reb David, this is an old war. This is what the world's about today. It's always been the same war. The left needs to shame all of the moral religious people. They need us to live with the same lost, the same shame and existential emptiness they feel. Haman couldn't stand to see Mordechai had to bow before him. And the left bullies and everyone's scared of them. Everybody. And one guy stands up, and the only one willing to fight, even his own party, everyone abandons him. David, this is our Muhammad. He's fighting our war, the purpose of Klal Yisrael. When you see someone fighting Amalek, you know what you're supposed to do? You're supposed to get him a rock to sit on and hold up his hands. I'm not saying Trump is Moshe Rabbeinu, but he's the one fighting Amalek today. And chas v'sholem not to be like, I'm sure there were people in Shushan who were kicking the backs of Mordechai's knees and saying, bow before Haman, trying to shame Mordechai, the Jews themselves. That's what we have today. Nadler, Schiff, Schumer, Yidden. Unbelievable the hezek they're doing. It's a pella to me that Donald Trump still loves us. The fact that he could look beyond these, I would become an anti-Semite in 2 minutes. The fact that he could look beyond this doesn't entitle him to look beyond something. Yeah, I don't even know if it's all real. Reb David, this is the cause of our times. Yaakov Shweki sang a song. Everyone has to support him in the way they could support him. A little hakar sataiv. You're supposed to be using your tools to support him. We should all write songs. And we should also add a few kinnis for those three, Schiff, Nadler, and Schumer. Serious, sad kinnis. Machrevel, Mimeich Yotzeu. This is the oldest. This is, listen, David, if nobody in the rest of this show does a proper job of defending him, I want you to have me back for a proper slot. And I'll undo the fact that this was even discussed about. I promise to make headlines great again.
Before we go to our guests, I want to say a short vart, both on the Parsha and the entire Elul and Yemei Adin. We just read the Parsha of Egla Rufa. You find a Cholol Ba'adama, a body, unidentified. In America, in New York, we'd go to Potter's Field, an unidentified body. But what do? We don't just say, no, just bury him. We bring out the Sanhedrin from both of the closest cities, and they measure it. Who was it closest to? And then they have to get up and they have to proclaim, Yodeinu lo shafchu es hadam hazeh. And Rashi says, we take care of our people. We give them food. We escort them. Nobody here is treated just like another, just an anonymous soul, another number. At the parasha, and Chazal darshan on Egla Rufa, why? Because kol Yisrael arevim zelazeh. That's the message of the parasha of Egla Rufa. And we see that in all the Yom Narayim. What do? We say, Ashamnu. Imagine if you go to traffic court and the judge says, did you go through the red light? And you say, Your Honor, we are guilty. He would say, excuse me, who's the we? I'm talking to you. Or a tax matter, whatever the case may be, you were speeding. Officer, we are guilty. Who's the we? Bagadnu, Gazalnu. Okay, you say that's an outlier tefillah. Well, look at all the alchets. Say the achet of Amida. Right, the chait of the tzibur and the quiet al chait the balachash al chait shechatanu. Why are you coming with somebody else's averus? Very tibetan, right? Who made you achray for him? You should be worried about yourself. It says kulan ovrim lefan of kivnei moroin. We stand as a yachid in front of kav yachol. Even the fish tzitter of Yisrael used to say, "Why are you talking about other people?" And look at the tefillah, tefillah zaka. What do we mispal? We say in tefillah zaka, if there's some yidola out there, right, who didn't do tshuva. So what do we say? Terachem al poishe yamcha pebeis Yisrael. Labal yidach mimenu nidach. Al ninel b'fneim darki et tshuva. Chatoir lohem chatira. Burrow for them a tunnel. Mitachas kiseik faidecha. Why are we so consumed with others when we're standing there in front of the judge on a life and death trial? Like, what's this chatar lem chatira? Let me share with you a story. Somebody was in the Redwood Forest. It's one of the most spectacular sites in the world. They're in California, groves, strands. They grow in strands of dozens or hundreds. And they grow up to 250 or 300 feet tall. And their girth could be 100 feet. So somebody's there. And he sees a ranger, one of the park rangers, explaining that he said this tree could be 3,000 years old. There's one tree there, they say it could come from the time of Avram Avinu. And he says the storms that these trees have seen, the earthquakes, the hurricanes. The Gemara says you stand up in front of a zaken. Why? Even a zaken guy. How many miracles did these eyes see when he's 70 years old? Now, what about something that's not 70 years old? It's not even 10 times 70, 700. But it could be 3,500. It could be 50 times. How many miracles did it see? How many hurricanes, earthquakes? So he asked the ranger, the roots of these trees must be so deep into the ground, like hundreds of feet deep to survive. Otherwise, they would topple. The ranger says, let me tell you the secret of the redwoods. And I believe one of the secrets of Klal Yisrael, Astaku Baraisu Bari Alma. He says they have very shallow roots, only 5 feet tall. The guy says, look, I'm an architect. You can't build a 300-foot building with a 5-foot foundation. It would topple on your first. He says, no, you don't understand. They're 5 feet deep, the roots, but they spread hundreds of feet in any direction. And they intertwine with the roots of the adjacent redwood trees. They make a lock. They engage with them, a permanent bond with all the other trees in the forest. The entire strand is locked together, is meshed in a steel mesh of all their roots. Kol Yisrael Arevim Zalazeh. What did Chassidim say? Miloshen Arev is sweet. All Yidin are sweet. They love each other. And by connecting to each other, when a storm comes, all the stress, it's like a building that holds itself together, gets sort of sheared over this mesh, this grand mesh that could go for 1,000 acres. And the shock comes out through there, and they all survive it because of that. A blessing, the blessing of this interlocking mesh, only 5 feet below ground. Below ground, it's not seen, but that, Barchenu Avinu Kulanu Ke'echad. He said, that's the secret of the redwood trees, how it could create, in such great height, how it survives so much. What does it say? Reimimanu Mikalashen, it goes on, Kal Yisrael. The tallest, the grandest, Kimi Gai Gadel. And they don't understand it. And the answer is, because we say Ashamnu, Bagadnu. Because by Maitse Chalal Badama, the poorest, most dilapidated, homeless, potter's field shlepa, what do we say? We bring out the Sanhedrin, and they say, Yodeinu Leshafru Es Adam Hazeh. No. When the young tree grows into this massive redwood forest, it joins into the interlocked roots. It grows through them, and it joins its roots. This is the secret of the Jewish people. So what does that mean for El Yimei HaDin? It says, Kulan Oivrim Lefanav Kivnei Morain, but the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, Tezvavim and Beis, I believe it is, says, V'niskarim B'skira Achas, we're looked at as one entity, the mesh. But to do that, we have to interlock our roots. My mother-in-law, Zecharyan Levracha, the Rebbetzin, Shoshana Mendelowitz, she was the principal here in the girls' school. She was the Rebbetzin for almost 50 years. She had an interesting anhaga. You know, we all get tzedakah letters, you know, tzedakah. You give to your few causes. She had every single letter that came in, about yidach mimenu nidach, got a dollar, $2. She would sit and write, and I never understood it, it seemed to me. But you know what? Kol Yisrael Arevim Zelazah. The more roots we interlock with, the more people who love us. Do you know that there was a study, it was done by Harvard, the longest study ever done in medicine. They took a number of graduates and they followed them for a 50 or 60 year period. It cost tens of millions of dollars. You know, most medical studies are for 6 months, 4 months, a year. This was a 70 year study, you can Google it online. And they said, what is the single greatest indicator of longevity? You would think longevity, it's good genes maybe. Maybe it's eating habits, exercise, we all hear about exercise, obesity, chas v'sholem, access to good medicine, money. Rich people live longer. No, no, no. Married people live longer. No, people with kids live. All, they put it all. And you know what they found out? The single biggest indicator of longevity is people who had strong relationships, a web of strong relationships, could be parents, children, siblings, community. That is the single largest indicator. Kol Yisrael Arevim Zalazeh, and Mitzad Sheni, Reimimanu Mikalashen Ki Migai Gadol. So this Elul, let's really make an attempt to reach out, to hug, to fill out that extra letter, to make that call. Kol Yisrael Arevim Zalazeh. Let's go to our riddle of the week. Pasuk says, "V'salamta mehem." When you see a lost item, "V'salamta loytucha le'salem," right? You can't turn your eyes away when you know. This is the same concept of Yisrael Arevim. We are one. We are one community. We take responsibility. You see something lost, pick it up and return it. Loytucha le'salem. But the Gemara darshins, sometimes you can be misalem. A zaken ve'ena lefikvaydei. In fact, the Rosh says that once the Zakein is nifter mitzvah hashavas aveda, it's aserlei, right? Because it's a zilzal in kavodat Torah, right? So therefore, you can't be mezalzal, and he doesn't do the mitzvah. Question is, if we're chayshish for kavodat Torah, why are we chayshish dafka by hashavas aveda? L'mashal, the Gemara says kiddushin, and daf memalef Rav Safra machrich resha, he would salt the fish l'kavod Shabbos. Ravah. Of it doesn't say resha of what. Ravach malach, she could have been of an animal. Ravach of a behema. Ravach malach shibuta, also salted a fish. Right? The Gemara says, Rav Nachman himself built the Micah for his bias. Why don't you say, just like Kol Yisrael Arevim, I'll cover that Torah is Mechayiv, that he's Pata from Hashavas Aveda, Mitzah Seida Raisa. Why don't you say, cover that Torah Pata's him from standing in the kitchen on Shabbos, for the real Talmud Chacham, from Binyan Amaika? You should say, let somebody else do it. Why did they do it by themselves? And it would seem that it's absorbing cover that Torah. That is our riddle of the week. Let's go to our guests.
We have the great honor of having with us Senator Joe Lieberman, Senator from Connecticut from 89 to 2013. He was a former member of the Democratic Party. He was the Democratic Party's nominee for Vice President of the United States in the 2000 election. And he was the only Orthodox Senator we've ever had in the Senate. Welcome, Senator Lieberman.
David, thank you. It's a great honor to be with you. And I'm a great admirer of you in many ways, really particularly because of the great tzedakah that you do. So it's great to talk to you.
Thank you, Senator. So many people in the Orthodox community are really scared about the possibility of a Biden-Harris presidency and its impact on Israel. Could you speak to that? And as an addendum to that, like, the squad, quote-unquote, or the left wing of the Democratic Party, how dangerous are they towards Israel and ultimately its survival?
Yeah, so it's a big question, Dave. Let me say that, start with a kind of reassurance based on my 24 years in the U.S. Senate and on keeping in touch with what's happening in Washington and the people there for the 7 years since I retired from the Senate. So, in my opinion, there remain strong bipartisan majorities in support of Israel in both houses of Congress. And historically, that's important because presidents of the United States come and go, prime ministers of Israel come and go. Sometimes the relationship between the two is good, sometimes not so good, but Congress over the years has become the great guarantor. And Congress, the bipartisan pro-Israel majority in Congress, which was, you know, built up for several reasons over the years. One are the connections people feel in values and interest, democracy between America and Israel. A lot of it is the tremendous work done by pro-Israel groups like AIPAC to build support from new members of Congress who have not had any experience in Israel or with Israel and may not actually have many Jews in their district. And the other great asset, and I put it right up there with AIPAC, is the Christian evangelical community, which, you know, believes in the Chumash, believes in Tanakh, believes in the Torah, and this makes them very strong supporters of Israel, and they're quite numerous. I have many friends. I'm laughing because I have many friends in that community who always like to tease me and say that there are many more Christian Zionists in America than Jewish Zionists, and you know they have a point. So I would start with a reassurance, and it remains true today, although in my life, and including my 24 years in the Senate, 7 years afterward now, I have seen a change occur, not that one party has become anti-Israel, another pro-Israel, but the Republican Party, both parties are pro-Israel. The Republican Party was less, how do I want to put it, reflexively pro-Israel in an earlier time. They are now very pro-Israel for a lot of reasons. Democratic Party was, you might say, reflexively pro-Israel for a long time. They're still very pro-Israel, but there is no question a group within the Democratic Party on the left ideologically including this group that you describe, that you mentioned, which is called the Squad, where they're at best skeptical about Israel, and often they have said things and proposed things that I consider personally to be anti-Israel. So, look, overall, this is a challenge we can take on, and a lot of groups, including AIPAC, are taking it on directly. I was encouraged by this year's Democratic National Platform, which is a pro-Israel plank in the platform, and I think Joe Biden and his team wanted to make sure that it was. I will now go to Biden briefly. I don't know really. I don't know Kamala Harris very well. I met her, but I don't really know her. But I know Joe Biden for more than 40 years, and I served with him for 24 years in the Senate. And apart from his positive personal characteristics, he's a good man. He's a great family man, honorable man, religious man. He has a long-standing pro-Israel record. So I don't think he's going to – he is the nominee of the party. And, of course, if he should get elected, he is the boss of the Democratic Party. So I cannot imagine a circumstance under which the Democratic Party under Joe Biden would become an anti-Israel party. Now, in fairness, I want to say that what is so, which is that President Trump has been extremely pro-Israel. And you know, I'm still a registered Democrat, even though I got elected as an independent last time. But I don't. It's not right to sort of for everybody, for people in both parties to just condemn everything the other party says. I am deeply grateful for the positions that President Trump has taken on Israel, and I must say, taking it one more step, and then I'll let you ask another question. This one was a big one, which is that I greatly support and appreciate the position that the Trump administration has taken on Iran, which I consider to be the most serious threat to security, stability in the Middle East, to Israel, and to the United States. And if there's one issue on which I really worry about possible Biden administration, it's this one, because I worry that the Biden administration may feel almost an obligation to try to go back to the nuclear agreement that the Obama administration negotiated with Iran, which, in my opinion, was a terrible agreement in many, many ways. Right now, we have the Islamic Republic of Iran, extremists, terrorists, on the run. On the ropes, and it's no time to stop punching them, basically, because if we don't incapacitate them, they will strike. They will strike America, Israel, and our allies in the Arab world. So that's a real long introductory response to your big question, David, and I'm glad to try to answer some more now.
So I want to touch on something, Senator, that you just said. There's been so much antipathy towards the Trump administration. I mean, just like hatred.
Yeah.
That you have to wonder how much of a backlash is there going to be if there's a Democratic president, just so much, just to strike back, like so much pent-up anger, right? And I'm curious, Iran being one of them, do you think the embassy will be removed? Like, where do you see the New York Times and its cohorts, like the rage of the media? Where is that going to? How do you see what type of a backlash do you think is possible or realistic?
Okay, interesting question. In other words, what type of backlash may occur if Joe Biden is elected from really anti-Trump people, right?
Yeah, it's almost a reflexive. They've been angry for so long. They're like, they just the volcano waiting to erupt, you know?
Yeah, well, you know what? It's a reasonable question. And a part of the problem with our politics today is that people in both of our major parties look at the other party as if they were like an enemy country, not like another political party composed of fellow Americans with whom you may disagree, but there's really no reason to hate them. And you're right, there's a lot of hatred here. I would say, starting at the top, that Joe Biden is not a vengeful person. So he will not he will not try to strike back at Trump or all the ideas that Trump had. Now, that's not to say that he may not change the policy that President Trump has had toward Iran, which I think has been exactly the right policy. And if Biden's elected, I'll do everything I can to try to convince him and the people around him that Iran doesn't deserve to that agreement that Obama negotiated with them in 2015. They deserve to be pressured. But on, let's take another example. On the question of the American embassy having been moved to Jerusalem, which I enthusiastically supported, I will tell you, and I apologize for the immodesty, that I co-sponsored the bill in 1995, which required the movement of the embassy to from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. I mean, what an outrage. Israel, one of our closest allies in the world, perhaps our closest, it's the one country where we did not allow the country to, the host country, to tell us what their capital was and therefore where our embassy would be. I am confident that a Biden administration will not tamper with that. In other words, won't move the embassy out of Jerusalem. In fact, the Democratic National Platform, which was adopted at the convention last week, specifically says that they will not support the movement of the American embassy from Jerusalem. So a certain number of the things that President Trump has done that I think are good things in the Middle East will not be changed. And, hey, you know, when we had introduced that law to move the American embassy to Jerusalem in 1995, it was supported overwhelmingly by members of both parties. If I remember correctly, my co-sponsor on that was either the Republican leader, Bob Dole, at the time, or maybe Trent Lott, who was to become a Republican leader, who was from Mississippi. And it got well over 90 votes. You know, almost all the senators, both parties, voted for it. So there really shouldn't be any disagreement now about the centrality of Jerusalem to Israel and, in fact, of course, to the Jewish people. It's our history.
So, Senator, touching on something you said before, and I know Biden. I've had dinner with Biden. And he is a moderate. He seems like a very nice person. But how powerful is that left wing? Like, I mean, the way Trump talks about it, you would think like there's thousands of them. You know, but in Congress, is it four people? Is it 10? Like, how big of a? They are clearly not friends of Israel. So the question is, how large are they? Are they growing? Are they, you know, right. When the Tea Party came in, everybody thought, like, oh, my God, it's all about the Tea Party. And the Tea Party sort of faded away into the sunset to a great extent. I mean, I don't know if you may disagree with that, but no. They certainly, we hear much less of them. Do you see the squad as sort of just, like, it's the flavor of the day, the people who say the outrageous things, some of them dress in Islamic things, it's just like, you know, the sort of the right-wing press is shining a light of them to try to make the Democratic Party look that way? Or are the progressives really growing in number? The universities are certainly off the wall left-wing, in my opinion. So the question is, are they the future, or are they just a few rabid outliers who will remain that way?
Okay, that's a really good question. So I will say that I have a confidence that the ones on the really far left and the ones who have been most willing to be anti-Israel, it's a small group. It's maybe five, maybe a few more. But I do want to say that I, as a Democrat, I worry about the movement within the party toward the left. A lot of them are still pro-Israel, but not as much as previous generations. Biden is not like that. He's really a mainstream guy. He's a pro-Israel guy. But, you know, and that's part of why I'm so relieved that he is the Democratic nominee as opposed to others like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, who could have been because they're much further over to the left, not only on the Middle East and Israel, but on a lot of other questions that matter to a lot of people here at home. So, you know, this is the challenge. Look, the parties are always changing. This is the nature of our big country. We're an unusual country because we have always had this two-party system since the, probably 1828 when the Democratic Party was formed, and then 1860 with Abraham Lincoln and the Republican Party. I wasn't there then, David, but I've read it in the history books. So these two parties have existed for a long time, and they change over time. So those of us who care about, one, being centrist and also care particularly about the two parties figuring out ways to get together and compromise so they can get something done on big issues that basically they just fight over, the national debt, the environmental questions, immigration, and I could go on and on. And basically they've ended up more in recent years just throwing stones at each other instead of really cooperating. And so, but that's our, it's up to us. And so here's what I'm saying. Real hardcore, unfriendly to Israel, small number in Congress. Basically, Democrats in Congress, pro-Israel. You can ask AIPAC. The voting records are the most objective way to determine clear. But there is, within what you might call the grassroots of the Democratic Party, a kind of among young people, a sort of skepticism about Israel. They don't view Israel as our generation did and the American generation like ours did, as the country that was formed after the Shoah, the little country that was surrounded by enemies. Now too many of them see Israel as a strong country, which thank God it is, but it's still threatened all the time. Terrorism in countries like Iran, and it still is, in terms of American values, the most American country in the region. And by that I mean the most democratic country, small d, and the country that reflects what an American term, which is real to a lot of people in our country, Judeo-Christian values. You know, for a long time in our history, the Christians found it a lot easier to say that. But I think more and more Jewish people are appreciating that there are a lot of Christians in America who, as a matter of faith, really are supportive of Israel and extremely respectful of the Jewish community, including particularly Orthodox Jews. I mean, I found in my political career, I'm going a little bit away from your question, but I think it may be interesting to you and your listeners. I found in my political career, both in Connecticut and when I had the honor to run as vice president in 2000, that the fact that I was Orthodox, that I was from, was actually not a problem for me politically, that in this country, majority Christians, particularly among those who take their religion seriously, they felt a bond, they felt a kesher with me, because I mean, I'll never forget the people would stop me and say, "Boy, I admire that you don't do your politics on your Sabbath," you know. So this is a remarkable country in that way, and I think it's part of why, if you poll the American people, forget Congress now for a moment, or the White House, the support for Israel remains quite strong nationally among the American people. And I think the religious connection is part of it. Also, obviously, that we're both democracies. That's a big part of it, too.
So just to sum up, you are sanguine and unalarmed that the Democratic win as far as Israel. You are a little bit concerned about Iran. Basically, you're saying that there is strong support for Israel. So
there is, and I just want to stress Biden again, because I know where his heart is. But I also want to say that I'm not overconfident about the Democratic Party and Israel, because there is a kind of a generational change going on under Joe Biden's generation and mine, that people who care about Israel and other elements of our foreign policy, these people, a lot of these folks on the left are really quite isolationist, which is not the tradition of the Democratic Party going back to Truman, you know. So that's my answer summed up.
So, question for you, Senator.
Yes,
Orthodox
sir.
Jews, for the most part, have been full-throated support for Trump.
Right.
And there hasn't been much sort of even-handedness or any sense of neutrality. And the question is it a mistake? Like, instead of, as a community, saying sort of, we are Republican, we are Trump, but be more even-handed, more neutral, because we don't know who's going to end up in power.
Right.
And in effect, you know, right now in the polls, you know, the Democrats are leading by, you know, fair amount, depending on which poll you
right.
do. But and the fact that many of them are pro-Israel, you say the majority. So is it a mistake as a community to, like, you know, just be so black and white about our allegiances? And should we be more judicious? What would you say?
Okay,
just
good
advice.
Question.
Advice to the community.
Yeah, no. I would say we have reached a point. The Jewish community has reached a point in America where it doesn't, if I may use a Yiddish word for a moment, it doesn't have to be behalten, that individual Jews or Jewish groups really have a right to be for whoever they want in politics. And I understand, and I see this, and this is not just for Trump, although he's really developed strength within the Orthodox community, but for some period of years now, the Orthodox community has been trending Republican, I understand that. I will tell you that as confident I am about America and the openness of America and the right that Jews have earned to be where they want to be politically, if I felt that the entire Jewish community was going for one party or the other, then I'd still say, okay, you have a right to do that if you think that the other party is really so bad. But there are consequences, and it's something to think about. But you know, the reality today, David, is that while the Orthodox community has been voting overwhelmingly for Republican presidential candidates, and I expect will do so for Donald Trump this year, that nonetheless the majority of Jewish voters in America are still voting Democratic. I'll tell you a story if you got a minute, and it sums it up. You know, I was very close to John McCain, and we were great friends, and you know he asked me to support him in 2008, though I had just been re-elected as an independent, but I was still a registered Democrat, and he thought he could use independent support, and so I supported him anyway, and I worked for him, I campaigned for him throughout the year. It's about a month after the election in 2008, he's lost, and we're on a plane, we're going to Afghanistan or Iraq or maybe both. And he says to me, you know, Joe, I saw an exit poll of Jewish voters, and I was really amazed that, and I forgot the number, it might have been 75% or 80% voted for Barack Obama. And he said, I don't understand that, because he's new, he says he's for Israel, but he hasn't been in the Senate long, had much of a record, and you know, everybody knows my record as long as I've been in the Senate. I've been strongly pro-Israel. What happened? So I said to him, John, first let me give you the good news, which I've seen an exit poll of Orthodox Jews, and you carried, I think, something like 80% of the Orthodox Jewish vote in 2008, but, you know, it's a minority vote. It's like 10, 12, 15% maybe. And the rest of the group voted big majority for Obama. So he said, why? So I said, well, unfortunately, there are a number of Jews in America for whom Israel is not a priority. You might say the social justice issues are more important to them. And they, on that basis, they vote democratic. And I said, it's maybe more complicated, but that's what it is. And So this is a long story, David, but I would say that the Orthodox community should feel comfortable voting for whoever they want to vote for, and I presume it will be Donald Trump. It happens that, maybe it's by shirt, that the overall Jewish community is divided, and obviously I presume again that a majority will vote Democratic, particularly for Biden, because he's had such a close and long relationship with the Jewish community. And so I wouldn't worry about it. I mean, thank God we live in a country where we're free to do what we think is right and not have to look over our shoulder all the time. And I hope and pray that that will remain so as long as America remains.
Now, Senator, how much of a, if there were to be a new Biden administration, how much would the Obamas have a hand in it? Like, is it going to be a Biden-Obama, or is it going to be, that was history, and now it's me?
Yeah, these are all good questions. my real answer is I don't know. I mean, I assume that two things. One is, and I've seen this in the past with other vice presidents, that this will be the Biden administration. Biden worked closely with Obama. They weren't that close before Obama asked him to run, but they developed a strong and loyal relationship. He's grateful to him. Obama has helped him and will help him more in this campaign. But it's going to be Joe Biden's administration, and it's going to be different from the Obama administration. I don't think you'll find Biden looking for reasons to insult Obama. On the other hand, I don't think he wants to run an administration where people think he takes orders from Obama. And frankly, knowing Obama a little bit, President Obama, I don't think he would do that. I think he'll maintain a sort of respectful distance. I mean, again, I don't want to harp on it, but if there's one thing I worry about, it's Joe Biden following the Obama policy on Iran, which is outdated now. It doesn't relate. It's 5 years ago, and in the 5 years since then, Iran has given us no reason to trust them, changed their behavior, not at all. And they don't deserve for us to go back into the Iran nuclear agreement, which, of course, I think was a terrible agreement from the beginning. They deserve to continue to have the pressure put on them to change. And we may hope that the people of Iran rise up, as I think increasingly they may want to do, and throw out this group of extremists. The government of Iran, in my opinion, is holding the country hostage. They're not really there because they're supported by a majority of the Iranian people, who are a cultured and intelligent people, no better than the extremists who run them now.
Now, Senator Lieberman, Senator Biden is elderly. Right, I mean, he would be the oldest president ever elected.
Yeah.
Right, and many fear that he's sort of they don't see him as a two-termer. Many worry that he could finish his first term, or many think that mentally that he's sort of wobbly. And I'm not. I don't know. I mean, I've had dinner with him, but it was a few years ago, once or twice.
Right.
I'm not stating any opinions. I'm reading just off the main.
Yes, sure.
You know. And so then the question may be, you know, geez, he's old style. He's not the left-wing new Democratic Party, et cetera, et cetera. But if he were to go into some type of a remission, or, like, you know, just get weak and suddenly the voices around him are much louder, A, is he surrounding himself by voices that are pro-Israel? And B, what does the support staff look like? Because they may be more important than any president before.
Yeah, well, first, I think Joe Biden's in good shape now. I understand he's 78, but, you know, people are living longer these days. And look, in our community, we have great regard for people who are older, and we have all sorts of examples of leaders of our community, and particularly Rabbeim, who continue to be a source of great leadership and wisdom on into years beyond 78.
Senator, let me rephrase the question. Nobody respects the elderly as much as the Jews. In fact, the word
zaken,
Zaken, the word old means zekanachachma. This is somebody who has acquired wisdom.
Yeah, that's right? Very nice. Good. It's
but I think what people are concerned about is, you know, he's made many missteps, verbal missteps, which is why there are some who say he shouldn't debate.
Yeah.
You have Fox had a whole segment about he may have dementia. I mean, so I have no knowledge, opinion, et cetera.
Right.
My point is, it's not about the fact that he's, you know, you have young people who are very old and you have old people who are very young.
Right. Right.
So it's more about his, you know, his actual health. And if there's any truth to any of it, but like, you know, he said 100 million Americans or something like that had died of COVID. I mean, he has had some missteps,
yeah.
as somebody who's on the air do all the time, by the way. But
right.
but my question would be is, if there's any truth to it, what does his support staff look like? You know, his, that's how I'm rephrasing.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, we'll see. But I know a number of the people who are high up and close to him. And they're solid, and they're not left wing, really. His group, I mean, there's a fellow named Ted Kaufman who chairs the transition committee, who was Biden's chief of staff in the Senate for years, and I got to know him. A wonderful guy. And in fact, when Biden was chosen to be vice president, he asked the governor to appoint Ted Kaufman to be his replacement for a period of time until the next election when Senator Chris Coons. So, I mean, he's typical of it. There's a fellow named Steve Ricchetti who's worked in government, very mainstream, solid guy. So, look, we won't know until it happens, but he's right now around him, he doesn't have you know, the kind of left wing of the Democratic Party in tight. And listen, he's a very family-oriented guy. And I would say probably apart from people like Ted Kaufman, who's been around him forever, his wife and his sister are probably the two people that he relies on most. I understand they won't be running his office every day. And so we'll have to wait and see who he chooses. But watching who's got the most important position in this campaign, there are people I happen to know because they've been around Washington for a while, and I consider them to be mainstream, and let's hope that continues. If he's elected, of course, that's critically important. You know, I used to joke, David, that when I was in the Senate, I never felt like it was a smart thing to do to tell how important my staff was. Now that I'm out, I can admit that, you know, the staff really has a lot of, obviously they have a lot of influence. The demands on a senator are enormous. The demands on a president are like 100 times enormous. So you rely on the staff around you to do a lot of the things that have to be done. And, of course, you hope that they reflect the values and policies of the person at top.
Can you share with us, Senator, one of you wrote a book about it, but your favorite,
yeah,
Shabbos story?
Oh, that's interesting. Wow. So, well, I mean, overall, the Shabbos has been, you know, I called the book The Gift of Rest because, though when I was a kid, I didn't always feel it was a gift. And when I went away to college, I did what a lot of people do. I went to Yale. I didn't go to yeshiva. I was joking. I went to the other YU, Yale University, not Yeshiva University. But so I left Shabbos observance for a while. But when I came out and I started to raise a family, I just was drawn right back to it, and it's been the center of my life, really. Well, I'll give you a political story. So when I first ran for the, and both of these, I suppose, interestingly, I'll do it quickly because I know you got to go and I got to go. Both of these are from non-Jews, but maybe this is important for the Orthodox community to hear, because and I know people in the Orthodox community know this, that so many non-Jews respect the Orthodox community for their emunah and halakha, etc. So the first one, I'm at the end of like 10 days before the running for the Senate election day, 1988. I'm running against the incumbent Republican senator. Really, I'm a long shot. Very few people think I'm going to win. I get a call from a friend of mine Con O'Leary, who's a state senator, Democrat. I always joke when I tell the story that Con O'Leary was neither an Ashkenazic nor Sephardic. He was a good Irish Catholic. He says, I called to tell you, I think you're going to win. I said, gee, that's great, Con. Why? Because very few people think I'm going to win. He said, I went to my mother's yesterday, and she's there, with three other Catholic women are having tea. And I asked him who they're going to vote for. This was 88 between George Bush, the father, and Michael Dukakis. They're all voting for Bush. I couldn't change their mind, O'Leary says. So then I said, well, what about the Senate race between Weicker and Lieberman? And my mother says, that's easy. We're all voting for Lieberman. And all the other women say, yeah, we are. So he says, why is that so easy? And he said, my mother said, I like the fact that he's a religious person. And he takes his religion so seriously that he doesn't get involved in politics on his Sabbath. So that's the kind of person I want in office. Pretty amazing. About the book, I will tell you this. A lot of stories in the book, but the man who was a Mormon, who was the president of Brigham Young University, which was the great Mormon university in Utah, he got a copy of the book, and he wrote me, and he told me that... I was out there speaking, so he told me this story in person, that he read the book, and he said to himself, you know, I'm allowing my smartphone to interfere with my Sabbath, which was, of course, on Sunday. And he said, I'm going to take the advice of Lieberman and turn my cell phone off on Sunday. He was the president of the university. So he said there was a panic on the campus the first two Sundays. Where's the president? You know, and but I said, little by little they understood, and of course he knew that if there was a real crisis, they could find him at his house. And he said, I feel so great about it because now I can observe my own Sabbath just like you observe your Sabbath. So that's funny; those two stories came to mind, but. I think they show what a gift Shabbat is and the appeal it has to people of other religions, in this case, particularly Christians in America.
Senator Lieberman, it's been a tremendous honor to have you on. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, David. All the best. I wish you and your family a wonderful year.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you, too. Bye-bye. We have the honor of having with us from Yerushalayim, Rabbi Emanuel Feldman. He was the rabbi of Congregation Beth Jacob of Atlanta, which is really the heart of the entire Atlanta community. He almost created the Orthodox community in Atlanta. He turned it from a small into a large community with day schools and yeshivas, girls' schools, a kol. He's the past vice president of the Rabbinical Council of America. He's the former editor for 13 years. He was the editor of Tradition, which is the Journal of Jewish Thought, published by RCA. He's the older brother of Rabbi Aaron Feldman, Rosh Yeshiva of Ner Yisrael. He's a musmach of Ner Yisrael. Welcome, Rabbi Feldman.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So, Rabbi Feldman, you are like an elder statesman in Klal Yisrael, and we see things now we'd like you to give us a perspective on. The Orthodox world is in great fear of the Democratic Party, justified or unjustified. We had on Senator Lieberman to just talk about that. And they speak about Trump, really, mamish, with the greatest covet and respect. There was a singer recently, made a whole song for him. I think maybe I'm not sure if in Deal they sing it for Shabbos Miris now, in front of hundreds of boys about the greatness of Trump. I think they sing it next to Yedid Nefesh. Give us a little bit of, on one hand, we have to respect the Malchus. A person has to have covered the Malchus. But give us some perspective. Is this the proper attitude?
There's an old expression in the Chazal, Kabdehu v'chashdehu. We should give honor to the authorities. We should also be very, very careful about what they stand for. This has nothing to do with pro-Trump or anti-Trump, but I think that writing that song was a mistake, and singing that song is a mistake. We have, as a Jews, we have immediate needs and we have long-term needs. Our immediate needs are education for our children, safety for ourselves, legislation that fights anti-Semitism, protection of ourselves and our communities from the mobs and so forth. So we have immediate needs, and when we go to vote, we should keep that in mind. But at the same time, when we go to vote, we should keep in mind our long-term needs, our ideal needs, and that we should not forget that Jews are an Am Kodosh, we're holy people, and we live by a higher standard, and we march to the beat of a different drummer. We have to be very, very careful not to identify ourselves completely, not knee-jerk identification with any single political party, even though sometimes we have no choice. We have to cast our vote for A or B, fine. But we always have to keep in mind who we are and what our long-term goals and ideals are.
So, Rabbi Feldman, when we learn the Gemara, which is brought in Shulchan Aruch and Kuf and Aleph, the Gemara and Avodah Zarah, you know, loisachanim, and the lashon of the mechaber is, you know, not to give inordinate kavod. Let me read a lashon of a mechaber in Kufnan Aleph Yudalot. Also l'saper b'shvachan, afilu loimer kamenoa akum ze b'tzurasei, kal v'chomer shiyasaper b'shvach maisav, o shiyachavir v'dava midvarav. Right? Aval in mechaber b'shvachan, l'haydis l'kadosh baruch hu itzmuta. Do you think that maybe sometimes we cross the line here?
I think we often do cross the line about that. I think, again, kavdeu v'chashdeu. We should give kavod because Malchus and presidency, whoever or whatever party, is really leiv melachim b'yad Hashem. It's that Kodesh Baruch Hu really is in charge, and he sometimes sends a certain type of melech over us. But at the same time, we shouldn't fall helter-skelter and body and soul into the lap of any secular leader. So there's no question about it. We have to give respect to authority. If were it not for authority, as Pirkei Avos says, the whole society would crumble. We have to give respect. We have respect to the police. I don't think it's a good idea to underfund the police as many people want to do. I think the police are very, very important. I don't at all approve of police brutality, whether it be in Israel or in the United States. At the same time, without the police, we as a Jewish people are at the mercy of the mob. So we have to give kavod and we have to give respect to authority. At the same time, we have to remember who we are and what our own standards are.
In other words, even though there's a halacha that says chelkin kavod lamalchus, right, to all malchus, but on the other hand, we shouldn't lose, sort of go head over heels and lose our own sense of identity and our own sense of mission and recognize that it's good and important, but we can't throw our ideals out of the window. We can't sell our soul because of kavod malchus. Is that fair to say?
I think I couldn't phrase it any better myself. I definitely agree with what you're saying. We should not knee-jerk identify ourselves with any political party, by the way. I don't think it's wise for the Jews or even for just Orthodox Jews to identify themselves totally with one party. No party should consider that we're safely in their pocket. Fact is that on a practical level, we can have much more influence with a political party when they don't take us for granted. And if parties that want our support have to make some effort to deserve some support, such support, by at least trying to enhance the sacred values which Am Yisrael represent. By the way, many years ago, Rav Shach Zatzal said the same basic thing here in Israel about not identifying with any single Israeli political party. So I agree with you 100%.
Now, Rabbi Feldman, Are you as fearful of Biden as the many others are in the Haredi world, in the Orthodox world?
Am I as what?
As fearful of a Biden presidency as many others are in the Haredi world?
Well, it gets into a political situation, but I wouldn't say I'm fearful of it, but I think we should be cautious as to who are the people supporting Biden. I think Biden is a very, very, very fine person himself personally. That's my impression. But we don't have any idea who his supporters are and whom he will allow into roles of authority in the government. So that is an issue that we have to examine very, very carefully without taking sides as to which party we should vote for, which candidate we should vote for. That is one of the issues that Jews have to think about.
Rabbi Feldman, do you think there is anything negative, again, going back to this Lashon Rosh Hashanah Aruch, Gemara and Avodah Zarah, of making heroes out of sports players, actors, or certainly sports players? Like, do you see anything negative in it?
Well, yeah, it depends what you mean by heroes. It's, we certainly shouldn't be looking up to any of these fellows. The fact that a guy can hit 55 home runs in a season doesn't make him someone I want to emulate as a human being. The fact that a guy can throw a 50-yard pass into the arms of a receiver doesn't make him a great person. The fact that a person gives a great speech as a politician doesn't mean I have to emulate him. Certainly, we have to be very, very careful. We can admire the skills of a hero. We can admire the skills of an actor. We can admire the skills of a writer and so forth. But to turn his skills into something I want to emulate and model myself on him or point to my children as a model, this is not something we should be doing. Our heroes are of a different stripe. Our heroes are the Rosh Yeshiva. Our heroes are our Talmidei Chachamim. Our heroes are our Torah teachers. Our heroes are those who know Torah and learn Torah. Those are the heroes we want to emulate.
Right. You know, Rabbeinu Yoina writes on the Pasuk Ish Lefi Mahalalai, he says you can judge a person not by Ish Lefi Mahalalai means usually the Pasuk Pshat is what people say about him. He says, no, it's about who he is Mahalal. So if a father sits by the Shabbos table and he talks about LeBron James or Jeff Bezos with a sparkle in his eye, so what do the kids take away from it? That these are the people who we should be looking up to. And so Rabbeinu Yoina says, Ish Lefi Mahalalai, you can gauge a person by who he is, and the children do that, or our spouses, or we ourselves do that. And the inherent danger in it is that we start juxtaposing or substituting skills for character. And Kal Yisrael always admired your shemayim in character as opposed to skill sets. Is that fair to say?
I think what you're saying is excellent. I think we should reverse roles. I should be asking you the questions, and you're giving me the answers because you're saying some very, very beautiful things today, and I appreciate that. 100% what you say, and I agree with that, and that's what I basically was trying to say earlier.
Yeah, and I saw recently a speech from a fellow, and he was bemoaning in the modern Orthodox world. He was saying a lot of the 17-year-olds know who LeBron James is, but they don't know who the Rajba is.
Exactly,
and that's
true.
That's a tragedy, and that's a real tragedy, isn't it?
Yeah. Many years ago, I gave a Yom Kippur sermon on the a few weeks after the Gera Rebbe was Nifter, and Lahavdil a few weeks after Elvis Presley, whom some of your listeners may not remember, who was a big, big, big rock star, after he died. And my theme was that there were hundreds of thousands of people at a funeral in the United States, and hundreds of thousands of people were Havdil at a funeral in Yerushalayim. Most of the Jews in the United States would not know the Gera Rebbe. They never heard of the Gera Rebbe, but they did hear of Elvis Presley. So So that is definitely true. The heroes that the world has are not always the heroes that we have.
So Rabbi Feldman, to basically encapsulate your message and try to make it so it's Laila Dilmad Adam Talmida Biderach Tsara, is that we have to have a circumspect and cautious eye, both from a practical point of view as well as a theological point of view. From a practical point of view is we should not pledge allegiance to any party, but rather to ideals. And secondly, our ideals should also have to have a big measure of them, is that who we represent as an Am Kaddish and an Am HaNifchar and a representative of the Tzelem Elokim in this world, and it can't just be for practical reasons. Is that basically encapsulating your message? What would you add or subtract from that?
That says part of my message. The other part that I would like to emphasize is a little more subtle than that, and it's this, that in our time, public immorality and lawlessness and dishonesty are so common in public life, and it's not limited to any one party. It's all over. Neither the Democrats nor the Republicans have a monopoly on that. They're so widespread that for a Jew, it's easy to inure himself to such behavior and to begin to accept it as normal. And from Jews have to declare that this behavior is not acceptable, that these are aberrations. It's not how mankind is meant to live. In other words, the attitude that permeates life today is, I can do whatever makes me feel good. And that kind of attitude can affect the Jew spiritually, even if he thinks it can't. But I think it can. It's like corona. It's insidious, and it's possible to become infected, God forbid, without being aware of it. So we have to be very, very, very careful, and we have to inoculate ourselves from such things. And one way to inoculate ourselves, I don't want to be giving a sermon here, but one way to inoculate ourselves from the temper of the times is to daven very seriously, to learn Torah very seriously, to give tzedakah and to do chesed very seriously. I'm emphasizing seriously, not just haphazardly. And that will help us inoculate ourselves from the times. The Rambam says, as you know, that when the society gets very evil, it might be a good idea to separate yourself from it and go into a desert.
Yeah, look, limit Boris, yeah.
Right, but we can't all go into a desert, but we can be very, very careful to separate ourselves from all this stuff. And even when we vote, we have to vote with an eye on who we really are, where we come from.
Rabbi Feldman, it was an honor having you with us. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. It's always good to talk with you. Take care. Sei gesund.
Also, bye-bye. Joining us from Denver, Colorado, is Rabbi Hillel Goldberg. Rabbi Hillel is a Talmud of Nevardik Yeshiva, Talmud of Rabbi Aaron Garbuz, as many as well as others. He was a Talmud of Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. He also has written two Svarim on the Bir HaGra in Shulchan Aruch, one on Mikvayis, on Reishayin, and he also wrote one on in Kufyud on Sfeikis, and two very complicated, with all the Shmaitzes, and so a big Talmud Chacham. He's also an American newspaper publisher. He's the editor of the Intermountain Jewish News, which is the Jewish newspaper for Denver, Colorado. He's a Rav. He's many, many more accolades, but we would run out of time. Welcome, Rabbi Goldberg.
Thank you.
So, Rabbi Hillel, you were one of the signers, and you were one of the primary editors on the letter that was recently published called Sinai, Not Washington. Can you give us the gravamen of what the argument was?
Well, the argument was based on a reality that creeps up on you so incrementally over such a long period of time that you don't realize it happened. And that is the degradation of discourse, the introduction of Nibul Peh, of language we'd never dream of using say 30 years ago. It started perhaps with the confirmation hearing for Judge Thomas. It proceeded through the Bill Clinton, you know, affair, and it kept going, and it's accelerated in the Trump age. So it's a long and unfortunate development, and so a few people felt that it was important to point out that we need to, that is to say, Orthodox Jews need to keep in mind always our own values when we engage in the political sphere, and not sort of unconsciously, so to speak, you know, fall into the language and the values that are pervasive in many parts of political discourse and activity in the United States today.
So give us a few examples.
So that's a problem, to give examples. I once wrote that to put up a legitimate Torah view on abortion has to an extent, the opposite effect, because the more you mention something, the more you routinize it. And once abortion, for example, is routinized, then you've lost the battle. So the kind of language that I'm referring to, I don't want to use. But I'm not sure that it's really a secret to anybody. One notices crudities, one notices profanities, one notices language that, is not our language. And it's crept into common discourse. And it's also a way of referring to people. It's demonizing people. It's not being able to disagree with people agreeably. All these aspects of our current situation, really, we need to be careful to avoid.
Speaking about sort of mitzvahs, are you talking about deis? Are you talking about policy, ideology, or are you talking
about policy. I'm not talking about ideology. I'm talking about mitzvahs. There can be legitimate disagreements on policy. There can be legitimate disagreements on what should be, on legislation. I'm not talking about that. I'm not trying to advocate or denounce any particular policy by any particular party. Trying to talk about mitos, about the way we talk about people, the way we look at people, the way we characterize people, the way, in particular, we characterize people with whom we disagree. I mean,
right.
It's no secret that we live in a very divisive time. Divisiveness is generated not just by differences over policy. It's generated by the language you use to express the differences.
So let me share with you. I have a debate, okay? In the current administration, I mean, in the current times, the president was recently at a parlor meeting, and a singer got up and he made a whole zemer about, you know, the greatness of the president, singing with like 100 kids or 50 kids, a boys' choir. And on one hand, I felt, you know, this, I don't think it's appropriate. Like, you know, this is almost like, you know, we're going to start singing Shabbos Miris. On the other hand, we have many historical examples, including people as great as the Shagas Aryeh, who came out with a Sefer Torah B'Yadeh to be Makabel, the Louis XVI's brother-in-law, Marie Antoinette's brother-in-law, who ultimately became Louis the 18th, right? So we have that, you know, as a historical example. We have many historical examples. You know, the question, could you be Haitzah Sefer Torah for a melech, for the current melech? In Megillah Saragusa, you know, we talk about it. There's arguably a Yerushalmi that talks about it, even though Yerushalmi could be talking about a melech Yehudi. The Chinuch talks about it. The Washington Chinuch is Nogu Begolus Hayim Lhoitzi Sefer Torah Likras. She's aim chiyuv. It's not a chiyuv, but he certainly named on that it was mutter. So, how do you fall on this debate?
Well, I think there's a radical distinction, a qualitative distinction, between appropriately honoring the head of the government upon whom the Jewish community is dependent, either to a greater degree or a lesser degree, depending on the kind of society. There's a great distinction between recognizing the political realities, the power relationships, and responding and behaving appropriately on the one hand, and between, on the other, absorbing the values of the non-Jewish society when those values contradict our own. Not saying that values in non-Jewish societies always contradict our own. But today, the way people express themselves and the way they people demean other people, degrade other people, these are not our values. So I don't really see a contradiction between expressing concern for an inappropriate absorption of non-Torah values and mitos on the one hand, and on the other, honoring and relating appropriately with respect to the head of the government. I would say that whether the head of the government right now is Trump or whether it will be Biden or whether it was Obama or any other American president.
So what, when you, I'm saying making songs and about him, et cetera, what would be your feeling?
Listen, I wasn't there. I didn't see it. You know, I don't know the context. Maybe it was a bit over the top. Maybe not. I can't say without really having, you know, been aware of, you know, what was going on.
Okay. What are your other thoughts on this matter? I mean, we have a president who is, on one hand, is very good for the Jewish people, very good for Eretz Yisrael. You know, he's done many things with Tovus Eretz Yisrael. On the other hand, there are parts about him personally that give many many Americans angst, especially when it comes to Midas. So how do we, give us some ground, or how would you relate to, how do we talk about him in front of our children?
Well, I would expand that a little bit. I should preface this by saying that since 1972, I've never disclosed to a single person whom I voted for president, and I don't intend to do that now. So what I'm about to say is not a pro or anti-Trump position, but I do think it is fair to say that in some respects, Trump has been positive, not just for the Jews. I think there's certain policies, particularly with respect to China, that have been good for the United States. I think there's more positive to Trump than just what he has done for Israel. But on the other hand, yes, the person is a problem. And the person was a problem when, you know, Bill Clinton was in office, at least after, the, you know, it became exposed what he was doing. And you've asked a tremendous question, you know, how do you talk to your children about this? That is a difficult question. Of course, it's easier to answer the older your children might be. But somehow or another, you have to convey, you know, respect for the office, respect for the policies that you think are good. Not everybody might agree with me on Trump and China, for example. And between, you know, all the other aspects that I'd prefer not to articulate. You know, we live in a society in which the assumption is that everything that happens has to be articulated. Everything that's said has to be repeated. I don't think that's necessarily a Jewish value. Okay, Rabbi Shmuel Salanter, who I've written about somewhat extensively, a couple of books, said not everything that a person thinks he has to say, not everything that a person says he has to write, and not everything that a person writes he has to publish. So I'm not sure we really should fall into this trap of needing to rearticulate or retweet, as it were, everything we hear. Silence is also a value, an important value in political discourse. I have a saying that I use, it's been very beneficial for me in many contexts, and that is, you don't have to defend what you didn't say.
Yeah, but Rabbi Goldberg, let me pose it this way, okay? I think, and I saw this from a modern Orthodox rabbi, I don't remember where he said, we have a problem in the modern Orthodox community that most of the children know who LeBron James is, but they don't know who the Rajba is. And I want to further it by saying that when a father sits down with his kids and we talk glowingly about sports figures, or we talk about political figures, and, you know, when kids see it, spouses see it, and we see it, and that's sort of like, or financial figures. You know, when you sit and you're sitting and by a kiddush and somebody's talking about Bezos and their eyes are glowing like Masei Yagiyu Maisav. I mean, this is what the Shulchan Aruch meant when it said that you should not be mishabeach somebody who's not a gadol b'Torah, right? In Kufnun, I think it's Kufnun Aleph, right? Nerudeya. In other words, the Gemara, that Ashri Ish Lefima, Adam Lefima Halalai. So it's true that on one hand, we don't want to say anything bad about anybody. But on the other hand, has there been sort of like we've become so Americanized that, you know, we don't say Sipuri Tzadikim anymore. We say Sipuri American celebrities. And that has a real impact.
Rabbi, maybe you think you're asking me a question. You're not asking me a question. You're mirroring my position precisely. Yes, we make idols out of the wrong people. Not that I should make idols out of anybody, but it is a problem. I'm not sure it's limited to the modern Orthodox community.
No. A modern Orthodox rabbi was courageous enough to say it. I'm saying it. You could be Haredi. You could be in any circles. You'll hear people talking about this gevir, this playa, this that. Maybe they know who the kid. Maybe the children do know who the Rajb is. But it does have an impact when we speak so glowingly about people, and it's not about their character or their Yerushalayim or their Torah.
Well,
and I hate to. I'm not a Benishkin Balmusa, and I don't give. But I'm just asking you from a theological point of view. You're saying silence is good, and I'm wondering maybe we should speak up about it, and we shouldn't be so silent about it.
Well, there's a beautiful, beautiful little chapter in the Sefer Or HaTzadikim, in which there's an argument between silence and speech. This is the way the author puts it down. So, Mr. Speech is asked to make his case. So he gets up and he makes his case, and when he's done. So the judge turns to Mr. Silence and asks him to make his case. So he speaks up and starts making his case, at which point Speech slaps him across the face and says, "You're using mine to prove yours. You're using speech to prove the value of silence." So the lesson you take away from it really is less an analysis, less than an evaluation, but just simply, sometimes talk a little bit less. I mean, your example from the sports figures is perfect. We need to be careful who we speak about and what we don't speak about. And it's not easy to do because these matters are so pervasive. They're in the newspapers. They're on the screen. You know, they're in the public eye in every possible medium. Restraint is important. But I will say this. Rabbi Shlomo Salanter said, it's worth giving a whole drasha on Lashon Hara, even if at the end of the speech, the only result is that one single person speaks less Lashon Hara, even if that person is you yourself who gave the drush.
Right.
I would say that from our little discussion here, if the only value is that one person comes away thinking maybe should be a little bit more careful what I articulate, the whole show is worth it.
Right. Rabbi Goldberg, is there anything else you'd like to add to this discussion?
I would. I'd like to, and I hope you won't cut this out, I'd like to compliment you on all the tremendous work you do in learning Torah and in dissemination of Torah and in other tremendous mitzvahs. It's really a privilege to talk to you. And if I have to look at somebody who I think embodies the ideals we're trying to articulate here, I would say your name.
Wow. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Rabbi Goldberg, it's an honor to have you on with us.
Okay, thanks a lot. Thanks so much.
Kol tov. Bye-bye.
Bye.